Hello, people of the internet. How's it going today? How you doing? I'm Billy Bones, and this is A Walk Through the Mind, a moment where we can sit down, hang out, chit-chat, discuss a handful of ideas that have been bouncing around inside my head, and see if we can't take those ideas for ourselves and go out and get the conversation started with friends, family, people we meet on the street, or maybe we just get those gears turning with our own heads and see where it takes us. So there's been a little bit of immigration news going on for the last little while. Something happening down at the old Tejas border. Got a couple people coming on in, legally, illegally, through the proper ports, across the border, across the Rio, over razor wire, or just through open gates in the fencing. All of the above. And it's big old hubbub. But it makes me think back to really the opening scene of Scarface. I'm going to hold off on that audio today. A little bit longer and a little bit more less PC than I'd prefer for the podcast, but not outside my normal viewing range. But it starts off talking about the 1980 Cuban boat lift. This little thing that happened between Cuba and the United States, again in April. It started off in April of 1980 and lasted for a couple of months, where 125,000 Cubans came flooding into this country, all at the very southern tip of Florida. It just seemed oddly appropriate, or a parallel, I guess, between then and now, looking at this massive influx of individuals fleeing a communist country to come here to the United States in search of freedom, a better life. It's a little bit different of a situation. Cuban boat lift started off with the taking of a bus in Cuba and running it through the Peruvian embassy wall, crashing through it, because there were stories, little telltale signs of people that were able to make it into the Peruvian embassy, sneak by all the guards, the Cuban guards, and police and whatnot, get through the walls of the Peruvian embassy, because an embassy is foreign land on your land. And those people that were able to get through were able to seek political asylum and be shipped off, sent somewhere else in hopes for a better life, not being stuck with the Cuban government, good old Fidel Castro, and the rigid ways of thinking. Because if you didn't adhere to those rigid ways of thinking, they had ways to punish you, Mr. Bond. And I guess it becomes an even bigger deal that the Peruvian embassy had actually just come back to Cuba. Cuba and Peru had a long-standing history since the early 1900s. Good old buddy buddy. And then the Cuban Revolution happened in 1960, and they said, nope, we don't want anything to do with this craziness that's going on. They closed up shop. 1972, they came back. They said, okay, you guys have chilled out, relaxed a little bit. We can go back to representing our nation here. We can be friendly, cooperative, figure out whatever embassy people do, go to parties. But the restrictions from the Castro government made things a little bit difficult. If people weren't lockstep in their thinking, punishments ensued. As mentioned by Lillian Guerrera, an author who has done some research and looking into the history of the Cuban Revolution.
I think that probably there's no other country in the world for which adherence to one grand narrative is as important as it is in Cuba. In Cuba, the construction of a grand narrative of a revolution that was totally redemptive, that had absolute support, and that had nothing in common with the past, that didn't reproduce any of the structures of the past, that was created in the first couple of years of the revolution, largely by the leadership. And after 1961, really adherence to that narrative, that singular narrative becomes mandatory. It becomes mandatory because no longer is participation at any level of the revolution a choice. You have to be a member of a mass organization to retain your job, to retain your status as a loyal citizen. You have to participate in rallies as a child. You have to be a member of the communist pioneers. At every level of your life, every aspect of your life, you have to be connected to this narrative.
Very rigid lifestyle. No real freedom. We're in it for the collective, the communion, the comrades pulling together, harvesting the sugar, whatever else they harvest there, to export it so everybody works out well. But it didn't work out so well. People had problems. And again, some individuals in a bus knocked down the walls and said, if people can get out through Peru, we're getting out through Peru. And with the toppling of this wall, people realized that the border is open. It's right over there. Because asylum wasn't available to be able to go out. You weren't informed of the world outside. Unless you also had relatives that were able to send you mail and come visit every now and again, let you know that, you know, there's a better life outside there, outside the walls of Cuba. So there ended up being 10 to 11,000 people that stormed this little tiny place in Peru, or Cuba, in the Peruvian embassy, overtaking the place, making it look like they didn't want to be there in Castro's Cuba. I'm so wrong about it. And so after a little bit of debating back and forth, Castro said, fine, if you guys that stormed the Peruvian embassy want to leave, leave. You're more than welcome to leave. Let us know who you're going to be contacting in the United States, and we'll let you go. But you have to be able to report when we say we want you to report so we can deport you, get rid of you. Otherwise, you're not allowed to go, a.k.a. you're ending up in jail. In the United States, a very loving, caring, open-hearted group of people said, bring them on. Bring them in here. Communism sucks. We're America. We don't believe in communism. Castro's a fool. We don't like him either. Bring them on. Bring them all. And so as long as you had a sponsor, a family member here in the United States, it was A-OK to bring back your Cuban family members from Cuba to the United States, let them move in with you, and they were going to eventually be offered migrant status, the chance to become a U.S. citizen. But things aren't that simple, because people were gathering up money and dollar bills and taking their boats, and they're going to go on down to Cuba, just go pick up a handful of family members. There's only 10,000 people that are going to show up. It's not that simple. Not when Castro is sitting there going, I can get rid of a whole bunch of people. I can get rid of all these people that are naysayers and dissidents. And so he would sit there, take the people that did want to leave and take some extras that still wanted to leave, and also decided to empty out his jails and send them to us, all on boats, ignoring the simple enough safety aspects of everything.
Politicians from several states tonight are sharply criticizing President Carter's handling of the Cuban refugee problem. The governor of Texas, Bill Clements, says the president has literally opened the floodgates, placing no limitations on the number of Cubans entering the United States. Today, the Cuban sea lift slowed a bit, but since last month, 25,000 refugees from Castro's Cuba have come to America. Between midnight and noon today, 23 boats filled with over 800 Cubans reached Key West, Florida. U.S. Marines are now on duty at Key West to keep order among the restless refugees waiting resettlement in the United States. The Coast Guard is urging the Cuban government to adhere to international treaties aimed at protecting lives at sea. Vessels like this one, the Dr. Daniels, were forced to take far more passengers than it has safety equipment for. And getting out of Cuba is still a problem for many. Many of those who have arrived in the States tell horror stories of being beaten by pro-Castro Cubans and secret police. And now reports that the Cuban government has stalled the sea lift operation for at least 12 hours, backing up boats in the refugee-crowded port of Mariel.
So still kind of early when it's only 25,000 that have showed up. But again, overloading the boat, sending too many people, not enough life vests or rafts. Women and children be damned. And so began this. I guess this was probably the beginning. It was obviously just a little bit before my time, before I realized anything was going on, of how the Cubans floating across the water in inner tubes to make it here to the United States. But these were all in boats from giant tankers. I guess not tankers, but shrimp boats, big old shrimp boats, to simple, small enough yachts that, not going to say millionaires had, but, you know, wealthy individuals down in Florida and along the coastline had. And again, overfilling them, making it so that way it became a rather treacherous journey for everybody. Castro didn't care if the boat sank. Just get these people off my island. Get these dissidents. One less mouth to feed. Let the United States have them. Have them all. And this influx of migrants, refugees, actually, political refugees, because they were being persecuted, attacked, for supposedly doing nothing wrong, just being let in, created some strife in the local community within Florida, very heavily populated area by Cubans. So much so that when they came in, you had the pre-existing Cubans who were very adamant to say that they were not Mariels, people that came over in this Mariel boat lift. Mariel is a harbor down in Cuba where they shipped all the refugees out of. And because President Carter said, just bring them on in. Bring them on in. If you don't want them, we'll take care of them because we love people. We love humans. And we think Castro's evil, so send them all. Thus, the flack from the governors, specifically Texas, how fitting, of just letting people come on in. But I'm sure some of this had to do with the Cold War and Cuba and Russia teaming up and at some point having missiles down there. Just not super friendly relations with them. And so if we could take people away from Castro and make it all better, we would. We did. Until, again, it became just a massive influx and overflow. And looking at the humanitarian aspect of, this is a dangerous trek to begin with, unless you get decent enough hardware and equipment to make it through. When you have the proper amount of lifeboats or life rafts and the lifeboats and whatnot, making sure that everybody's safe, not over encumbered. But so many people were pouring in that they actually did have to pull the plug. They said, fine, that's enough. No more. You can't send any more. And if you do send more, we will find you. We will impound your ship. We'll take your license, all this fun and groovy stuff, which definitely caused a problem for some of the people that went back for multiple trips to keep pulling people out to save these people. You went down there to save them, and then all of a sudden Carter says, no more. And I'm sure hopefully there was some heads up, but there was definitely no cell phones or internet back in the day to make it quick and easy to hear about, but they had radios. I'm sure there was some communication about it. Some people being down there at the port of harbor waiting to get loaded up, forcefully loaded up on people, maybe held extra long to a point. And what does Castro care? He's not going to get arrested if he overfills your boat and send you on your way. But some people just didn't care. They came back or couldn't make it back in time before the deadline. And things got expensive quick.
The arrests followed the arrival of the Red Diamond with 731 refugees on board. It left Mariel Bay 8 days ago. During that time, the voyage was plagued by misfortune. A fire broke out on board, and several people became ill as the ship inched its way across choppy seas to the Key West docks. A woman gave birth just 3 days ago. She was among the first to receive medical attention. A Coast Guard inspection team termed the conditions aboard the ship appalling. In all, there were 68 arrests, including the Cuban Americans, the crew members, and the captain of the freighter. With Panama's permission, the U.S. government stripped the freighter of its Panamanian registration, allowing the owners to face fines of over $700,000. Other countries which serve as registers of ships are also being asked by the government to cancel the registration of any ship used to carry Cuban refugees. Diana Gonzalez, Channel 4 News.
$700,000 in 1980 dollars. Oh, I do not want to do the math for inflation on that one. That's a lot of money. It's a lot of money for, I'm sure it was more than just the migrants. I know I heard something in the total research. I think it was $1,000 per migrant that you could get fined for. I guess that does work out to $1,000 per migrant. 716 there and $700,000. Yuck. For disobeying the government, for bringing back people from communism. But you got to worry about the bad apples. Most of these people, again, fleeing for good reason, but within the grand total of numbers, it's assumed that a portion of them were less than stellar individuals. Out of 125,000, I've lost my numbers. I don't know if it was 25,000 or 2,500. Big difference in numbers. It's either 2% or 20% of the individuals that were sent over didn't have sponsors. They actually were ne'er-do-wells going through, stealing, fighting their way, resuming drug crime. Or maybe they were just so discriminated against for being a darker skin color, number one, or number two, a Mariel Cuban as opposed to a naturalized Cuban or a U.S. Cuban, Cuban-American, however we choose to label them. And so you definitely had an influx of, again, these less than stellar characters, and they're not getting shipped all over the country. They were. There's a clip within the show notes that has them talking about the people getting shipped out to New Jersey, New York. But if you've got the majority of people showing up into just a handful of small towns in southern Florida, that I don't know if they double the population in those towns, but they definitely make a dent. And then you have the unsavory individuals that start doing crime or can't get a job for whatever reason. Makes everybody look bad, especially all these new arrivals that are out there trying to make the best of things. Because they're here. We want them to have the best of success.
Most Mariel immigrants became successful. Most did what they came here to do, what all immigrants come here to do, which is to adjust to life in this country and improve their lives. But one cannot expect that immigration is chaotic, as spontaneous, as really as abnormal as Mariel, would result uniformly in success stories. And along with the success stories, there are also the stories of people who did not fulfill their dream.
Again, the bad apples were the people that were just down on their luck, just got dealt a worse hand on top of a worse hand and couldn't dig themselves out. But the Cubans have always seemed to have a better immigration status with the United States than pretty much anywhere else, or so it all seems to go. And especially with the Cuban Americans down in Florida, strong-arming people saying that this is how they want things to go. Because shortly after the Mariel boat lift, Haitians started making their trek. Haiti, not too far from Cuba. They started coming in their own little fishing boats. And they would get turned around even if they made it to dry land. It's actually one of the things that came in after the Mariel boat lift was closed down, that it was the wet feet, dry feet policy for Cuban migrants. If they caught the Cubans in the water, they'd scoop them up with the giant fishnets and then take them back to Cuba, drop them off, and say, better luck next time. Don't do it again. But if you made it to the United States, you got your feet dry, you walked around on land, you're able to get the ball rolling, get something started in the chance that you might even be able to become a United States citizen. But Haiti, with its economic depression that it was having, that was going on, they said, no, you're not allowed here. You're not a political refugee. Your country just sucks with money. You're not welcome here. Send them back. Got to come through the proper channels. No illegal migration from Haiti allowed. No. Which reminds me of a clip I saw the other day of the Dutch Royal Air Force guarding the borders of the Caribbean coast. Not sure which island down there, but just north of Venezuela. Venezuela seems to be having some financial issues as well, and people are out there in inner tubes and little fish dinghies floating across the ocean trying to make it to a better spot. And that's not that the Caribbean has a wet foot, dry foot policy like the United States did, but the illegal population is definitely a lot higher than they would like it to be. And they do their best, the Dutch do their best, to make sure that they catch everybody who's in the water and send them back to Venezuela. Your problems are not our problems. Stay out. And then there's comic strip blogger. I'm not digging out links for him, but he's posted quite a few links that Poland has a border. They got a giant wall. And he seems to be rather proud that people don't get in too easy on around Poland. Neither here nor there for me, but just kind of one of those things that's being made aware of, that migration's always a thing, political refugee or not. It's always been there, still a thing, always will be a thing. Not everywhere is sunshine and rainbows. People are always going to look for the grass greener on the other side of that hill, the other side of that fence, and especially with places that offer the chance and the opportunity to make something of yourself, be it in the Caribbean, where there's already a huge illegal population and people are willing to work and subvert things and make it all happen under the scene, under the radar for people. Or here, where it's such a giant, vast land, that shining beacon of a city on a hill that people want to aspire to be part of. They want to assimilate. They want to be an American. They want their white picket fence, their 2.5 kids and a dog, maybe a cat and a fish, to make something of themselves, not to be told by a state or another larger controlling entity on what they can or cannot do or become to live out their full potentials. So the Mariel Boat Lift. I'm not here to give you homework or whatnot, but I think there's a good enough reason to start looking into things, understanding where people come from, mentally, emotionally, politically, or maybe just on the map, like from Cuba, south of Florida. But I'm not. I'm from the internet. I'm Billy Bones, B-I-L-L-Y-B-O-N, the number 3-S. You find me on Twitter, at Billy Bones. You find me on Mastodon, the Fediverse, at Billy Bones, at noauthority.social. I've got a website, in case you don't have the social media, because there's nothing wrong with that. It's at billybones.com. Remember that it's spelled with the number 3 instead of the letter E. And there you can find links to show notes. Got a whole bunch in there for you today. Again, not homework, but research. A couple of news clips that you obviously heard. Definitely a lot more of those. There's a documentary in there on the YouTubes that you can watch. Hopefully you like subtitles and some older footage, but it's worth a watch. It's worth digging into just a little bit more. But also on that website, there's a link that says Value for Value. Because I release this show free of charge with no paywalls, no advertisers, nothing to take up any extra of your time, just me and my voice and my product, my effort, my love and joy, handed to you on a platter in your little podcast app, hoping that you find value out of it, be it the single episode or the entire catalog. I hope you do. Because if you do find value out of it, I do ask payment in return. The first form of payment that I ask in return is that you give this show a share. Maybe someone else gets a talking point, gets the gears turning, finds a reason to take a boat down to Cuba and pick up some people. But if you found that this show was worth more than just a simple share, then you can go to billybones.com. You scroll all the way down. There's 2 links to look at. Number 1 is Tabletop Woodworks. That's my woodworking project business. Click the link, see what's available through the Etsy website. So that way you can get a little more value for the value that you've received from the show. But if you think that the show is good enough on its own, you think that I deserve a beer or a boat, maybe a whole island. Again, you scroll all the way down, you click that Value for Value button. It'll take you to PayPal. You can chip in, you donate, you support the show in the number that you feel is appropriate. Like today's executive producer, Lady Get Over It, sending in her monthly $10 donation. Thank you very much, ma'am. But if you don't like those fiat fun coupons, the Federal Reserve Freedom Units, and you've got yourself one of those new podcast apps, modernpodcastapps.com, and you can send in some Satoshis, teeny tiny bits of Bitcoin. And I've got 2 people to thank today. Number 1 is Dame Slamy, sending in 3,166 Satoshis through the Castomatic app, saying, thanks for another great episode and a reminder to stock up on Texas ammo. Yes, ma'am. You're very welcome. Glad I could help you look out. And then our next executive producer being KR, streamed in a total of 212 Satoshis through Podverse. There's apps out there, people. There's ways to send in your money. You don't have to send it all to me. Just little teeny tiny bits. Not looking for a lot. But I'd like to thank you very much for listening. I love you guys. And I will talk to you next week.